This is Fresh Air. Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of the Americans who fought the Cold War. He was President Carter's national security advisor. Brzezinski's area of expertise was the Soviet Union and the Communist Bloc. Now that the Cold War is over, he's written a book about the global crises that developed in its wake. The book is called Out of Control. He's now affiliated with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and he's a consultant to global corporations. I asked Brzezinski if he ever thought the Cold War would end.
Yes, I did, because in fact I wrote a book back in the mid-80s outlining how I thought the United States might win the Cold War peacefully. It was called Game Plan, and the last chapter in it was entitled Prevailing Peacefully.
Do you think the United States won the Cold War?
Well, sure. Of course it did. The Cold War was between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Soviet Union disintegrated. Its bloc has fallen apart. The United States is still in Europe, in NATO. The American sphere of influence now extends even to the former Soviet Union.
Many would argue it's not so much that we won as it is that the Soviet Union collapsed, not because of us, but because of their own problems. And
these problems are not unrelated to the Cold War. After all, the Cold War was a major strain on the resources of both countries, but the Soviet Union was less productive, less dynamic than the United States, and the strains proved much deeper, much more burdensome.
Jimmy Carter, in his memoirs of his years in the White House, said that at a cabinet meeting once, you made this analogy about the Soviet Union. You said, under Lenin, the Soviet Union was like a religious revival. Under Stalin, it was like a prison. Under Khrushchev, like a circus. And under Brezhnev, like the U.S. Post Office. Can I ask you to extend the metaphor? What do you think of Russia as being now?
Well, under Gorbachev, I think it became increasingly like a large corporation going into bankruptcy. And under Yeltsin, it's like something experiencing a leveraged buyout.
Tell me why you make that analogy.
Well, I mean, because he's so dependent on foreign support and financing.
Let me ask you about Bosnia now. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has ruled out the use of force in Bosnia, but that is still a subject of great debate in the United States. What would your recommendation be?
First of all, let me say that I think the peace process headed by Vance and Owen has been a disgraceful sham that has really facilitated the aggressors.
How has it facilitated the aggressors?
Because it interfered with the possibility of any pressure being applied against them. The so-called negotiators were against the threat of the use of force against the Serbs. In effect, the peace process provided an umbrella under which the Serbs had one full year to wage a war, which they're now close to winning. When Mrs. Thatcher said yesterday something that I agree with very much, namely that at the very least we ought to give the Bosnians the arms they need to defend themselves, she was denounced by Mr. Christopher as being emotional, a rather suggestive put-down, very patronizing. And secondly, he said that it would increase the carnage. Well, that's like saying that giving arms to the anti-Nazi resistance in occupied Europe would be increasing the carnage, because the people who were being slaughtered by the Nazis wanted to resist. I find that both morally and geopolitically appalling. And as I talk to you, I'm reading, literally right now, a last-minute appeal issued by the commander from Srebrenica, the town that's about to be taken. And he says, bear in mind that at this moment, 10 a.m. Central European time, today, 10 a.m. Central European time, the aggressor is only 1,200 meters from the center of the city. 80,000 innocent women, children, and old men will be slaughtered and run over by tanks. We plead for urgent intervention, etc., etc. You know, we're sitting here and listening to this, and later this week we're going to be celebrating the opening of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and we'll probably be all saying never again. Well, doesn't that mean something in terms of the choices we now have to make? I find that morally truly appalling.
What would you say if given the chance to try to talk President Clinton into the use of force?
I'd say to him exactly what I've just said to you. Namely, from a moral point of view, this is abhorrent, And from a geopolitical point of view, this smacks of the kind of short-sightedness that Chamberlain demonstrated, namely, propitiating the aggressor does not create stability. When this is over, Kosovo is likely to become the next field of battle and will have established also a very dangerous precedent for the former Soviet Union that ethnic cleansing can in fact be undertaken and executed with impunity.
What about the argument, though, that there's really no way of winning this war through the intervention of American troops?
Well, first of all, I really don't believe that argument. I don't know what it is based on. But secondly, I'm not even advocating at this stage anymore the deployment of American troops, because I don't think we should do this on our own. And it's quite evident that the West Europeans are not prepared to bite the bullet. But I'm saying, and I'm saying it over and over again, at least let's give the Bosnians a chance to defend themselves. What possible justification can one put up against the proposition that the Bosnians have a right to defend themselves?
So do you mean lifting the arms embargo?
Yes, exactly.
And would you like to see the United States then give arms?
We could give them arms, but there are plenty of countries that are willing to give them arms, starting with Turkey, which is in the immediate proximity. But certainly, I think we should give them arms. But even if we didn't, others will, once the embargo is lifted.
My guest is Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was President Carter's national security advisor, and he's just written a new book called Out of Control. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Zbigniew Brzezinski. Let me switch to another part of the world here. You say in your book that you think the threat of Islamic fundamentalism has been oversimplified, that there's in fact little political unity in the Islamic world. Let me ask you to elaborate on that statement.
Yes, I am concerned that we may be sliding into a self-fulfilling prophecy by painting all Muslims as somehow our enemies. And you see this on the level of serious analysis, where the fundamentalist threat is always associated with Islam. And you see it on the more primitive level of cartoons, which in effect are trying to stereotype Muslims in a rather unfair and occasionally even very vicious, racially vicious fashion. The fact of the matter is that there are some Muslim fundamentalist states which are hostile to us. The best example, of course, is Iran. But there are Muslim fundamentalist states which are friendly to us. In fact, perhaps the most fundamentalist Muslim state is Saudi Arabia, which is extremely friendly to us. And Morocco is very conservative in that respect, too, and very friendly. There are also secular, non-fundamentalist, non-religious Muslim states which are very hostile to us. Libya, Iraq come to mind. And there are Muslim secular states which are very friendly and pro-Western. For example, Tunisia or Indonesia. Last but not least, the Muslim world of 1 billion people itself is very differentiated. You start with West African Nigeria, you go through the Maghreb of North Africa to the Middle East, within which there is Egypt, then of course further east, Persia, the Persian Gulf, down the new Central Asian states, all the way through Pakistan, Bangladesh, to Indonesia, a Malay culture. So the notion of identifying the fundamentalist threat with all of Islam is wrong, factually, and dangerous politically.
The wave of militant fundamentalism that we're seeing now was touched off by the Iranian Revolution. I'd like you to look back to the period during that transition from when the Shah was in power to when the Ayatollah was in power. And this was the period when you were national security advisor to President Carter. I believe you supported the Shah. And I'm wondering if, looking back now, if you second-guess any of the decisions that you made and how the United States should handle the Shah and its policy toward Iran.
Well, the only thing I would second-guess is that we underestimated the personal weakness of the Shah. And I mean by this not only the extent to which he really was weak in the country, but personal weakness in a truly personal sense, that he was a weak man. And that therefore we should have probably pushed him harder to do what he should have done. because I think there was a time when it would have been possible to suppress the fundamentalist rising, and then on the basis of that suppression to undertake the needed social and political reforms. Instead, he equivocated, and we essentially stood on the sidelines, urging him to assert himself, but at the same time saying to him, but be careful, don't use too much violence, don't use too much force. And that contributed to his vacillation and uncertainty.
Just one more question on Iran. How does an administration like President Carter's that bases so much of its foreign policy on human rights, you know, how did you and the rest of the administration justify supporting the Shah when, for instance, the Shah had secret police that was known to torture dissenters?
You know, what I find very interesting about these concerns is that they never apply, for example, to the Soviets or the Chinese, with whom we have dealings and to whom we often give credits and whom we often greet in this country as our guests. If we are to pursue a policy of an absolute commitment to human rights and not have dealings with anyone, whether he's friend or foe, because they violate human rights, I think we'd be very, very much alone in the world. So in every situation, you have to make some judgment also about other considerations. And the simple fact of the matter was and is that Persia is a very important country in the Persian Gulf. And having a good relationship with Persia is important and generally better than having a bad relationship. And the same incidentally applies to the Soviet Union. I didn't hear people who object so violently to the Shah's violations of human rights object, for example, to even Gorbachev being treated as a friend at a time when there were still political prisoners in Russia under Gorbachev. So if we're going to make human rights into an absolute, we better be prepared to apply it on an absolute basis.
One of the things that you're doing now in your work is advising global corporations. What are you advising them on?
International conditions. What are the likely patterns of political, economic change in different regions in the world? What kind of degree of stability or instability can one anticipate? What is the likely pattern of developments on the world scene, etc.?
Are you advising any businesses to locate in Russia?
I think some, under some circumstances, yes. But I think great caution needs to be exercised regarding location and the kind of arrangements because of enormous legal regulatory instability.
Did you go through a period of depression when you left the government?
No. Why? Why should I?
Well, because you have less power, for one.
Yes, but I'm very sort of, if you will, historically minded person. A historically minded person is a person who has a perspective on today, which is derived from the knowledge that prior to today there were many yesterdays and there are many tomorrows. And I was acutely conscious of the fact when I was in the government that I was in there just temporarily and that this was not my real life, though it was a very exceptional, very challenging period of my life, and that it wouldn't endure. So that when time came to pack my bags, I was not surprised.
You're still with the Trilateral Commission?
Yes.
What does the Trilateral Commission do?
Well, as you probably know, it's a worldwide conspiracy organized by rich people to dominate the world. If you're a leftist, then of course the emphasis has to be that this is a monopoly of millionaires to dominate the world. And if you're a rightist, you probably also know that this is a conspiracy to impose on the world one world run by people like Rockefeller, Kissinger, and myself. So you can pick.
And give us
and if you happen to be in the small rational minority, you know that this is a club of fairly prestigious people who together meet and hold discussions and have, in effect, an annual meeting, which has occasionally some influence, but not terribly much. So you can decide which camp you want to be in.
You sound amused.
Yes, because I've heard questions on this subject very often.
President Clinton is nearing the end of his first 100 days in office. How do you think he's doing so far?
I think he's doing very well domestically. I'd give him a high, very high grade for that. For foreign policy, I'd give him an incomplete or maybe ABS, absent. That is to say, a grade which is suspended because you don't yet know what the record will be.
Zbigniew Brzezinski has written a new book called Out of Control, Global Turmoil on the Eve of the 21st Century. This is Fresh Air.